I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we talk gardening with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. Good morning.
Good morning.
And unusual spring. We're a little bit behind.
Well, we're more than a little bit behind. I'm, you know, just looking at my yard and looking at what I see in the environment around me. We're a good 2 weeks behind the average year. But, you know, this is Cape Cod. Every year is different. And we, by July, we've all caught up.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll catch up.
I hope.
And you know, in a lot of ways, I was actually kind of happy we're a little behind because, you know, normally I plant, you know, all my coal, like the spinach and peas and all that. On St. Patrick's Day, we had snow.
That's right. That's
there was
right.
No planting on St. Patrick's Day, and I really just recently got some of my vegetables in the ground.
Well, you know, a lot of it also factors around soil temperatures because all seeds have a particular temperature which they really like to germinate, and the soils have been somewhat chilly. They're now up in the 50-degree range, which is good for most vegetables. Beans like it around 60, and on a sunny day, I have raised bed, so it's not quite the best representation. On a sunny day, my soil temperatures are warm.
But so it's okay to put them in now because they won't germinate right until it...
Well, they germinate best around 60 degrees for beans specifically. Mm-hmm. But for other vegetables, last week I planted beets and carrots and Swiss chard and radishes. Normally, I'm planting those in late April.
You know, me too. I just did the same thing.
Yeah, and they've sprouted. So I've got good germination. The soil has warmed up enough for the plants that we normally plant, you know, like 2 or 3 weeks ago. Go out there and plant them now. They'll be great.
I know, and I told you I wasn't going to plant anything in my... I have three vegetable beds,
right.
Raised beds, and I said that I'm going to take them down and just do one in another section. I broke down. One of them has planted things in it.
Yes.
I just couldn't resist.
I planted potatoes as well.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I did that 1 year, and they have a very pretty flower.
They have a very pretty flower, but I found I've always grown potatoes, but I gave it up the past couple of years just because I don't have the room and they're a lot of work. And at the community garden, there are so many Colorado potato beetles. I just threw in the towel on that. But I planted these at home, and it's a new variety from a Rene Garden Seed called Belle Beauty. And the original stock came, it's sort of a heritage potato from Brittany, France.
Oh, wow.
And it's a small, very thin-skinned potato, sort of creamy, brown, yellow in color on the outside. And around all the eye spots, it's suffused with blue.
Huh.
So they're really a beautiful-looking potato. And I'm visioning potato salads with just a vinaigrette, no mayonnaise, so I can see the color in the potatoes.
Have you tasted them before?
No.
So that's a report we'll be looking for.
Well, to me, a potato is a potato in terms of, and I've never met a potato I didn't like.
Yeah, no,
so.
I'm with you there. Yeah. I love potatoes too. So kind of damp, and we should talk about the gypsy and winter moths.
Mm-hmm.
I am so thrilled to see the apple blossoms on my apple trees. I mean, I don't see any at all. I mean, I know there are some out there, but the populations are really down.
The populations are very low. They're out there. I've seen them in my yard, but in so few numbers, I don't feel it's worth doing anything about. This may be the first year in the past decade that I'm actually going to have, it looks like, a bumper crop of my Asian pears.
So you're not spraying?
I'm not. I rarely spray, and when I do, I try to spray particular plants rather than broadcast materials because I just don't want to impact pollinators or beneficial bugs or stuff like that.
And just for a little tip for homeowners, if your flowers are blooming,
don't spray
because you're going to kill the bees.
Yeah. You know, I always recommend spinosad, products containing spinosad for things like caterpillars. And once it's dried, it doesn't affect bees. But if it's wet, it does. And so if you're putting it on a flower, a plant that's in bloom, and a bee comes to visit that flower, even though spinosad is a very safe material and has no impact on humans or pets, when it's wet, it will kill bees. Mm-hmm. So be cautious as you use it.
And the gypsy moth also down, but also as if it continues to be a little bit damp, there's going to be even less, right?
That's a good thing for the for us in terms of gypsy moth. Maybe not so much if we're trying to sit outside in the sun. But last year, the reason the gypsy moth population crashed, because we had a fairly big population last year, and it was very dry. through April and May. May is when they hatch out of the egg masses. And as we went into June, we had a period of wet weather, and it activated the fungus in the environment and basically caused the population to crash before they pupated. Mm-hmm. But some of them did. So we do have gypsy moths out there as well, but very, very low numbers this year.
Yeah. And we mentioned last time you were here the winter moth population being down because of that parasitic fly, right?
Correct.
So that's likely to continue,
yes.
Right?
Yes. The thing with biological control, it's slow, and it takes a long time to establish itself. But once it's established, it remains at levels that are high enough to keep the pest population low. It doesn't eliminate it. I mean, and that would break the cycle because it has to have the pest population in order to replicate itself. So we'll always have some winter moths. But I think I'm going out on a limb here. I think the days of the massive defoliations by winter moth specifically, hopefully, are a thing of the past.
So what about the trees? We had those, you know, several years in a row where the trees were just defoliated and they bounced back.
Mm-hmm. Some didn't.
Yeah, it's stressful. Mm-hmm. So what kind of shape do you think those trees are in that have had that decimation for a few years in a row? If we have a nice, good, you know, they have some water, they'll be okay?
Maybe? It's questionable. I was driving down, I avoid coming through Falmouth directly to get here, so I go to Fit 151 and down 28, and there are an awful lot of oaks along that strip between 151 and by the time you get into Falmouth, that are dead.
Yeah.
They're not leafing out at all.
That was a hot spot. Yeah.
So they're just dead. And that's a problem in a couple of different ways. It presents should we get into a prolonged drought, it presents a fire hazard risk. And also, if we have lots more storms like we did last winter, we're going to have a lot of them come down. Now, if they come down out in the forest, who cares? Not in your yard. So if you have trees that are potentially very weakened by multiple years of defoliation, you might be advised the safer thing to do would be to have them removed.
Right. Teal says, I have a macanthus plant that usually grows close to 10 feet tall each year and gets wider each season. I have not seen the usual new growth this spring. How long do I wait until I know for sure it is dead? It would be a great loss to the garden.
My miscanthus is very late to grow this year, so I think it's just a factor of the relatively cold season so far. It's alive. I can see some green shoots, but it's usually up about, 6 to 8 inches by now, and not even close to that. It's still down in the crown. I'd give it another couple of weeks. If it's a very, very, very large root system, good luck. You might need a backhoe to dig it out.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not. Hopefully it's just the cold weather.
If you have a question or a comment for us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Since you're talking about that, we should mention the hydrangeas. I was walked around and went, oh boy, I got to cut these things way back. And then I noticed, I think it was yesterday even, that there was a little bit of green on.
Oh look, there's life.
So they're just blooming out a little bit later?
There was definitely, it depends a lot on what variety cultivar you have. We're talking about the blue hydrangeas, the mop heads, not the white hydrangeas, the paniculatas. In my yard, I have several cultivars. One is called Tough Stuff. I have three Tough Stuff. This winter didn't even make them blink. They've leafed out all up and down. I have one called Blue Billow. I can see flower buds on it already. The winter didn't touch it. Lady in Red looks fabulous. And then I have some other ones that are collection of sticks that I've got growth coming from the crown, but the stems themselves are dead. And then I have some others that I thought were just going to be a collection of sticks, and I went to check them out to see which ones I need to prune because I'm ready to do it. And lo and behold, some of the what I thought were dead stems now have foliage coming out. So this was why it you have to wait until the very last minute to prune your hydrangeas. So I expect I'm still going to get some blooms on those plants I thought I would not.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, they've taken a hit, as you know, few years. But the French lace cap, they seem to do okay. Yeah. There'll be a few branches that die back, but they seem to be in my group of hydrangeas. They're the ones that...
Well, that's
seem
the
to make it.
My tough stuff is a lace cap. Lady in Red is a lace cap. I have a couple of other lace caps that have no name because I planted them so long ago. I don't even remember what they are. They look fabulous. Yeah. It's more the mop head type that seem to have taken a hit.
Yeah.
But you know they are they look like a collection of sticks. And but if you wait and are patient, and just if you the sight offends you, look at a different part of your yard. wait and wait and wait. And now that they're finally starting to show some signs of life, now you safely can go and prune out the stuff that's obviously dead.
Yeah, I moved one of my white, and I thought, oh boy, I don't know. I dug it up maybe, might even be 3-4 weeks ago now. I moved it, and I thought, okay, let's see what happens. And it looked like a pile of sticks, that. It's got green little buds on it, so I'm thrilled that it made the move, because you just never know.
You never know. And this winter was so difficult on certain plants. A part of it was we had such a warm fall, which we totally enjoyed, but for some plants, we didn't seem to have that slow, gradual cooling down that triggers dormancy. It just went from, you know, really warm to sort of cool, but not freezing, and then single digits. And then in February, it warmed up. We had some gorgeous days, I think three of them in February. And then it got very cold again. So I lost 3 roses. And I've had other people, and I work part-time at a garden center now, and I have people come in saying, you know, my roses died. People who had big heather collections, a lot of heath and heather died. I mean, things that you normally think are totally rock solid. In my herb garden, my sage, which I have had for years, dead as a doornail.
Oh.
So I always tell folks, you know, if you're losing plants, it's an opportunity to do something new. So... Dig them out and go to the garden center.
I've pulled out all of my roses over the last couple of years. And I shouldn't say I have two. I kept two. But mostly because I'm so tired of getting jabbed by those stupid thorns. And now that we have the little guy running around in the yard, I thought, you know what? We're going to take that thorny stuff right out. So you're right. I've put new things in there. All right. Deborah's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 2 years ago, I planted 7 rhodies, and they have done nothing. I holly-toned them in the fall last year and again this spring. My old rhodies are doing great, but these have like maybe 1 or 2 buds on each plant.
What are their growing conditions, particularly in terms of sun, shade, et cetera?
Part sun, part shade.
Well, that's good. Are they in a soil that is moisture retentive, or is it kind of droughty?
I would say we have a lot of clay.
Okay, so very moisture retentive. Yeah.
Yeah.
And have they put out new foliar growth every year?
Yes.
So they're growing well, just not blossoming the way you'd like them to.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes rhodies take 4 or 5 years before they actually settle in and start blooming on a reliable basis. I put one in a long time ago called Calsap. It's a beautiful, beautiful plant. And it didn't bloom for 5 years. And now it blooms regularly every year. So it might just be a question of maturity.
Okay, good. I'm not doing anything to harm them then.
No, it sounds like you're doing everything right. You might... If they're growing underneath trees, you might consider limbing up so a little more light comes in. They actually like a fairly good source of light rather than full direct sun, but they don't want deep shade either.
Okay, that might be contributing to it, too.
Yeah.
Deborah,
All right. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Love your program. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. I have 2 climbing hydrangeas, and... One of them, I think it's just a little bit too shady.
Yeah.
It's been there quite a while. The other one, I'm hoping, will bloom this year. And what is it they say? The first year you plant it, it sleeps. The second year it creeps. Third year it leaps. I think I'm on year 5.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that's true for many plants, but for climbing hydrangea, it takes at least 5 years.
Oh, good. Okay, so this I think this is 5 for the second one I planted. So I'm going to be looking.
They're
for
They're notorious for just basically sitting there for 5 years, and then boom, they take off.
I mean, the green has taken off. Yes, they look great, but it's just the
what exposure do you have them in?
One of them is between the two holly trees under a maple tree,
so very
going
shaded
up the maple tree. Yeah, but the other one is more sun. So I'm hoping that one is, that's the one that got planted most recently.
Yeah.
So.
The one I had planted in the wrong location going up my chimney, you know, in one's enthusiasm, one makes many mistakes that one later corrects. It was beautiful. It was on an eastern exposure, so it got morning sun, all morning sun, beautiful sun, and then total shade for the rest of the day. And, oh, it was just fabulous. Yeah, and it grew all the way to the top of the chimney, and then I realized it was damaging the bricks.
The chimney, this one gets the same thing, mostly morning sun. All right, Lucas is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Lucas.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good.
Just over the winter, we had obviously some snow and some wind that knocked over the arborvitaes and Leland cypress. So I staked them up, did the hose trick, put the hose around the wire. That way I wouldn't hurt the tree. When can I remove my contraption?
If their roots were damaged when they went over and they're big trees, it's going to need some assistance for a couple of years until the roots regenerate. Otherwise, the side that where all the roots broke is always not going to give you the tree as much support as it did previously. So if it's only been staking up the trees just since they went down this winter, I'd probably say you need to do it for at least a year, if not a little bit longer.
Yeah. Lucas, how big are those Leyland cypress? How big are the Leyland cypress?
I'd say about 10 feet now.
10 feet. Yeah,
that's a big tree to stake up, and it's going to take a while for its roots to regenerate. Sorry for not good news, but if it looks weird, you might just have to enjoy the weirdness for a year or two.
All right.
Is there anything I can put in terms of like fertilizer to help with the root growth?
I don't think so. You would be better off mulching it so the soil stays cool and keeping it moist so the roots have a good environment for growing. If it's a hot and sort of dry location, that impedes root growth. But if you can keep it cool and moist, that would aid the root growth.
Lucas, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking gardening this morning with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 for your garden and bug questions. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Ed writes, last year, much of our vegetable garden was wiped out prematurely by powdery mildew, which had been only a minor nuisance in the past. What do you recommend as prevention and treatment if it shows up again?
Well, not all vegetables get powdery mildew, so if everything in your garden was affected, there might be something else going on. But squash is notorious for getting powdery mildew. Cucumbers get powdery mildew. There are mildew-resistant varieties, so when you're ordering your seeds or picking out your plants, you might want to keep that in mind and look for those that are resistant to it. Also, there are biological fungicides that will reduce the effect of it. So go to a good garden center where they have some educated employees that can talk to you about the products and look for one of the biological fungicides that to take care of it. The thing about powdery mildew, it's an interesting set of organisms. There are many different fungi that we call powdery mildew, but they're different species, and they're all pretty much on specific plants. So powdery mildew of lilac is not the same organism that causes powdery mildew of squash. But they're what we call obligate parasites. They need a living host. So they don't directly kill the plant, but they do weaken it and over time just make it decline. So it is a good idea to, if you see it, take care of it. It loves, powdery mildew loves humid weather. I saw it coming in probably mid-July last year, and I had it fairly well on my zucchini. So sometimes you just need to plant extra.
So you're mentioning, let's talk a little bit about hybrids and this whole, you know, native species versus native cultivars and, you know, what's better? Is one better than the other? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different points of view on this particular subject. Some people are very pure native plant people. They don't even like cultivars. Cultivars are basically, you can have cultivars of a native plant that have been, so you have a, say you have a population of plants and a smart plant breeder sees, oh, look, this one's a little bit different and I like it better. So he selects that particular plant and then breeds that one. Then you have a cultivar. It's still the same native plant, but it's been selected from a population for certain characteristics that might make it more desirable to the gardener. Some argue that those same characteristics make it less delightful for pollinators, particularly many of the doubled and ruffled flowers make it difficult for the pollinators to access the nectar, or some of these plants may have less nectar than just the straight species. For most people, I think, you know, we have so many blooming plants in our gardens that to not plant some of the lovely cultivars that are available is sort of depriving yourself while you've got all these other plants that the pollinators will come to. So I like to say have a mix in your garden, you know. Enjoy the beauty of plants and flowers while including those that have not been tampered with, just so the pollinators, in case your cultivars aren't good for them, have something to rely on.
And of course, some of the hybrid vegetables, like the hybrid tomatoes, you might have less problems with disease and stuff, right?
Well, that's the other thing. I mentioned the powdery mildew on the squash and the cucumber. Many cultivated varieties that have been bred to not have powdery mildew. Their plants are just resistant to it. So there are some benefits to cultivars and hybridization. You get insect resistance, but particularly you get disease resistance. So it's something to consider.
All right. Paula is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Paula.
Hi. My question is there something attacking rhododendrons on the Cape?
What are you seeing?
I have probably a 50-year-old rhododendron, and it's right next to, 5 feet away from another rhododendron bush. And over the course of 2 summers now, it's just slowly dying. It's turning, just the one near it is fine. The leaves turn black. It puts out, you know, ever so a minimal amount of leaves in the next season. I know they're evergreen and don't really lose leaves, but it's just very slowly dying, and now it's pretty much gone, and I'll have to, you know, put something else. I'm worried if I put another rhododendron in the same spot, it's going to get the same disease.
Is this in a location that is where the soil perhaps is on the dry side and it doesn't receive a lot of irrigation?
No, it's regularly watered. I mean, it's on the coast, but that it's blocked from the ocean by the house.
How is it watered?
With a hose. Sprinkler system.
Okay. What I found in my own yard, there's a section where I had two lovely yaks, rhododendrons, Yakushimanums. And it was on the edge of the woods, and I didn't pay quite as much attention to watering. I use an overhead sprinkler. And the soil was sort of droughty. And a couple of years ago, we had a rather severe drought. We didn't have rain, it seemed like, from April until September. And the following year, one of them started declining and eventually died. And then last year, the one next to it started declining. And now every year I prune more out of it, and it's down to, it was huge, and now it's down to a couple of stems. And I'm attributing it more to damage caused by a drought 2 years ago than any disease or insect, because I find no disease or insect on it. Sometimes we don't think about what happened in terms of rainfall several years ago, because the effects of drought sometimes take 2, 3, 4 years to show up.
And these are shallow rooted.
They're very shallow rooted. If you're right on the coast, you might have a drier soil. I'm suspecting it's more a root problem related to drought than an insect or a disease.
Anything she can do?
Even though that the plant right next to it, the rhododendron right next to it, is fine?
Well, it's been there not quite as long, I believe you said. The other one was pretty old. There may be a difference in how, when you irrigate, how the water falls. There's so much we don't see between two plants right next to each other. There's always some little difference in the environment that favors one and doesn't favor the other. They may be a different variety as well. You could always take representative samples into the Master Gardener Clinic at the Cooperative Extension Service. They're there 3 days a week from 9 to 3. And if you bring not something that's totally dead, but something that's showing sort of symptoms of decline, and take that into the Master Gardeners, they can more thoroughly examine it and perhaps come up with something for you.
Hey, Paula, thanks.
Located.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Where is the Extension Service located?
It's in the it's in Barnstable Village in the Deeds and Probate Building, which is on Railroad Avenue, right behind the big Superior Courthouse. And the Extension Service is located on the bottom floor. And they have a plant clinic where they will take samples and talk to you and help you diagnose plant problems. So
okay,
they're
terrific.
Great.
Thanks.
Yeah, great. All right, thanks, Paula, for the phone call. Jane is calling from Orleans. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I'm just calling, and I think I might just have gotten my answer listening to the last caller, the Extension Service for getting soil tested.
Yes.
Would that be Barnstable Village?
It's Barnstable Village. They only test for pH. So if you're looking for a more complete soil test, UMass Soil Testing Lab does a complete soil test for $15. And you can go
to... How do you contact them or... on the Cape, where are they located?
Well, the Master Gardener soil testing is right in Barnstable Village in the Extension Service office.
One that you mentioned?
Yes, in the Deeds and Probate Building on the bottom floor. And they will test for pH, which is your basic test that mm-hmm. you need.
And to do something else, you need to send it off.
For do something else, you need to send it off.
I need to send it off, and mm-hmm. that's my question.
Yeah.
It to.
If you would send it to the UMass Soils Lab, and if you go online to the UMass Extension website, they will give you full directions on how to take a sample and how to send a sample. And I believe it's $15.
Yeah. Right.
$15. Well, I've lost all my grass pretty much to many colored mosses now.
Yeah.
And it's beginning to look more like the field above it. And it does grass. And so I thought I'd make a minor effort. I don't want to be feeding it all the time and so on.
Right.
It was very good when we built the house, and I did do that and spent a lot of money keeping up on it. And then I said, I can't do this anymore, yeah. and said, okay,
yeah.
and went underground. So I don't have much grass.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make one more comment,
sure.
if I could. And that is my continuing sadness over the fact that somehow the state has been convinced not to allow us to grow things like the burning bush and the, I'm looking at it out the window here now, not mulberry bush, whatever that other one is.
Bittersweet, probably.
I bought those things before Massachusetts said you could no longer plant them. And I have to say that they're the only things in my yard that continually look good, grow good, have never required water or fertilizer. And they're just growing beautifully. And I think there's no problem with those plants in somebody's yard. I think the problem with things growing wild is out in the woods someplace or in grasses that aren't taken care of. But it's a real shame.
Yeah, well, Jane, we will say that even if it's growing in your yard, it does get in. It does, they're invasive. They do spread the birds, and they bring them to the woods and other people's yards. And I know that I think they're a beautiful plant as well. But, yeah, you don't want to have too many of them around. Yeah. Roberta, you want to be thoughts?
Well, I had a lovely burning bush that I really enjoyed. And then I did start finding seedlings far away from where that bush was planted, and I eventually cut that bush down and removed it, and that was probably 10 years ago. I am still pulling out euonymus, which is what a burning bush is, euonymus seedlings from the woods in back of my house, and I know they came from that original bush. Mm-hmm. So while you may not see the problem directly in your yard, birds love those seeds, and they carry them, and then they become problematic. And what that does is it changes the composition of the forest floor, which then affects the critters that live in the forest floor. It affects their food source. Japanese barberry is another one. And in certain sections of the forest in Massachusetts, barberry has taken over, and it's a thorny plant, and so it impedes passage of certain animals and also prevents other food sources from growing in there. So while we may love it and it may look beautiful, there are other plants that are equally beautiful that don't have that invasive property.
Right. Jane, thanks for the phone call. Catherine is calling from East Dennis. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
We have a dogwood that we put in probably 4 to 5 years ago. It's in the front yard. It's facing sort of southeast. It has its own space. It's not really crowded. It's not exactly ever been vigorous. And it seems that it's greening up, but there's a pitiful number of blossoms on it. It was put in by a landscaper who's long gone, unfortunately. And so my question is, does it need something to stimulate more flowering?
Is this, the first question is this the native flowering dogwood or the Coosa dogwood?
No, it's the native with the bigger blooms.
They, and what town did you say you were in?
East Dennis.
East Dennis. And is your soil particularly sandy?
I wouldn't say particularly, no.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if it, and we put in a drip.
Okay, so it gets adequate moisture.
Yeah. And it's I would say maybe 10 to 12 feet out, there are other trees, but it's not in shade. It's kind of got its own spot, but every year it seems we have fewer flowers. I'm looking at it right now, and the flowers are at the top, and not much going on the bottom half, I would say.
Is the bottom half more shaded?
Nope.
Nope?
Nope, but just pitifully.
Yeah.
On it.
It used to be, when I first moved up here, the native flowering dogwoods all looked lovely. And then sometime in the 90s, the dogwood anthracnose organism moved in, and many, many, many of the native flowering dogwoods took a severe hit from that. And the ones I see now all seem to be somewhat struggling. And I do see, I saw some growing in the woods, an actual native dogwood, and they did have flowers coming out, but as you describe it, it was mostly on the top, not on the lower branches, which I find is kind of interesting. Do you fertilize it at all?
I had been, but I'm wondering, am I using, and don't ask me what the balance was, because I don't have the box in front of me, but what do I need in terms of the three numbers?
Well, what I always like for dogwoods and rhododendrons is Holytone. It's just a wonderful fertilizer for a lot of the plants that like low to medium fertility, not applied, you know, a big, like if you put down 10-10-10, woo, it's ready, available, and you get a rush of growth. But this is, because it's made of natural materials, it's more of a slow, steady release of nutrients to the plant. And I find dogwoods really respond well to that. So I'd give it a good fertilization with some Hollytone and see what happens next year.
Yeah. Hey. Catherine, thanks. Barbara is calling from North Chatham. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Roberta. This is one of your former workers, the water lady.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm fine. I have two questions. First, if you want to know what to plant, go to somebody else's garden or to a sale of local plants. And I, 20 years ago, bought this plant that was a bleeding heart.
Yes.
There are now bleeding hearts because everybody comes over and sees this unbelievable plant that nothing keeps it from growing. And the more I divide it, the bigger it gets. Mm. I can't believe how I just recommend it for everybody. It's just like a miracle.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite plants. And you mentioned sales. I should put in a plug right now. The Master Gardeners are having their plant sale this Saturday the 19th at the fairgrounds starting at 9 o'clock this morning. Get there early. You can get wonderful plants that you may not be familiar with because Master Gardeners grow incredible things. Mm-hmm. I myself have benefited from that Master Gardener plant sale.
Yeah, those bleeding hearts are really. I have a white bleeding heart.
So do I.
Yeah, yeah. So they're so
a
pretty.
White one. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, I didn't know they had white ones. They're very hard to find in a place like Agway. But,
yeah.
Boy, if you can get one from a neighbor.
Yeah,
that's great.
I believe in propagating what is already growing well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I find if something's happy, I often have seedlings that I can either dig up and give away or dig up and move to a different part of my garden. So that makes me happy.
Yeah. Barbara, thanks for the phone call. Did you have another question?
When I was at a Mother's Day thing, they gave us all a little sprig of white dogwood. Now, I've already had a bad experience with dogwood in my yard. It's a Corneus floridea. Is that the one that's dying on the Cape every time you plant it?
Yeah, Cornus florida, that's the Native American dogwood. Beautiful in bloom, but subject to dogwood anthracnose. So,
And I've lost two of them already, so I'm not going to plant this.
The Cusa is, while it's an Asian dogwood, it's resistant to anthracnose and still gives you a lovely bloom a little bit later in the year than the Native American. But if you love the dogwoods, then I'd go with the Cusa.
All right. Barbara, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking gardening with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Dana writes, I was wondering what the best lavender to plant was, or maybe what the differences are. There seems to be taller ones or ones that have larger flowers and then a whole plethora of other varieties. My local garden center doesn't seem to know the differences. I've planted almost all of them. I've lost a few and kept a few. Is there any way to keep them in terracotta pots?
No.
Dana is in Provincetown, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, in Provincetown, perhaps, because Provincetown is one of the, areas of the Cape, it's milder because it's surrounded more by the water than say, interior Cape Cod.
I'm always jealous in the fall when you go there and everything's still blooming and we've had our frost already.
I've had the best success with the varieties of English lavender. Mm. Hidcote, Munster, they're your basic lavenders. They like full sun and extremely well-drained soil. They do not like wet feet, so that's the key. The French lavenders are lovely, but I don't think they're as hardy. And the Spanish lavenders have an absolutely gorgeous flower, much different in shape than your basic English lavender. But again, I don't find them as hardy. I would recommend, I'm hardly a lavender expert, but there's the Lavender Farm.
Which is a great place to visit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The Lavender Farm in Harwich, I believe.
And they will know their lavender.
They know their lavenders back and forth. So rather than me giving you a specific recommendation, I would heartily recommend that you go there and visit and talk with them.
Yeah. All right, Linda is giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Linda.
Hi. I have two questions, actually. I know Roberta's probably addressed this many times, but I tuned in just as she was speaking about powdery mildew, and I didn't hear her mention, but it's certainly been noticeable to me that if I water at night, which I know is kind of a no-no, it's like it takes a week and all of a sudden I'm seeing powdery mildew show up.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And also if I spray with a hose as opposed to walking around with the hose, I don't have an irrigation system in my vegetable garden. And, you know, sometimes you get lazy and you just get the hose going and it's spraying from the top.
Oh, yes.
It's a killer.
Yeah. I use overhead irrigation, your basic oscillating sprinkler back and forth. And I let it run for a long time. So I keep a little rain gauge out in my garden so I know how much water I'm putting down. But I'm very careful that I'm watering in the morning. So by the time sun goes down, the plants are dry. Mm-hmm. So if you're watering late in the day or actually watering at night, you're encouraging disease organisms. So you need to send them to bed dry.
Yeah, Linda, thanks for reminding us.
I'm encouraged by the fact that you do water overhead, though, and that's still okay.
Yeah.
Because
yes,
that's
it is.
The only way I really can do more than a few at a time.
Yeah.
I'll just make myself do it at the proper time of day.
To be honest, it's not the most efficient use of water in the garden. The most efficient use is soaker hoses, and I had a wonderful soaker hose system when I was running the demonstration garden at the fairgrounds. You know, I don't have that in my yard. So
I don't have it either. And, you know, the water source isn't that close by. And, you know, it would have to be wound up every time my husband mowed the lawn. And so that's not going to work.
Exactly.
Yeah, they get mad at you with the hose in the yard. Yeah, I'm with you, Linda. What was the other question?
Other one is I have plants all over my yard that came probably back in the 50s and 60s from Minnesota to my mother's yard in Maryland. And I brought them 45 years ago to my yard here on the Cape. And they're what I call a cowslip. I mean, they're like an old-fashioned primrose, and they are just the best plants ever. And I'm wondering why they do so much better here than the primroses that you see in the nurseries.
Yeah, that's the bright yellow form of yes, I have that, and it.
Me too.
I have a number of different primroses in my yard, and the structure of the flower is called a hose in hose. It's different from the flat open primrose flower, and mine is just so happy. It seeds itself. I have clumps coming up in partially shaded areas, and it's bright. I even have it in a very, very sunny area, surprisingly, and it's very happy.
I do too.
Yep, it just seems to do better.
It just, for whatever reason, I attributed it to the fact that it came originally from Minnesota. Before it ended up in my yard, but I probably have. I probably have 80 plants in my yard.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just because I divide it and divide it and divide it and divide it. And so now it's borders everywhere.
Yeah, it's a wonderful plant. I did buy some primrose over the past several years that have that in its breeding. And they also, it's a specific species of primula. And I'm blanking on what the specific is, but it is.
Where did the cowslip come from?
I believe it's from England.
Yeah.
Okay. That must be what it's referred to because I have a spode china pattern that has cowslip the name of the pattern. Okay.
Primula vera, perhaps, is the... So check that out. But I have some hybrids that have it in its breeding, and they also are doing quite well.
Yeah.
Good.
And they have they have that same hose and hose flower pattern. So they're very hardy and spreading and making big clumps.
Yeah. Linda, thanks. Thanks for the phone call. Let's see. Henry, Martha's Vineyard says, I recently replanted a privet hedge from a different location. It's looking very thin. Is it too late to prune?
No, it's not. You can go ahead and prune and it should put out all new growth and look better. Give it some fertilizer at the same time. It should look better by, you know, midsummer.
Yeah. We were talking about, you know, picking something like the bleeding heart, taking it and moving it to other sections, which works well. But I have found, I have, the orange oriental poppies. And
oh, they're lovely.
They do fantastic in most of my yard. There's a couple places I put them, but it seems like everyone that I dig some up and give to, it doesn't do well in their yard. Isn't that weird? But
yeah.
It seems to love, for whatever reason, it loves my yard.
Some plants are like that. Yeah, you know, they're happy where they are. When they get moved, they're not happy.
Like, don't move me. Yeah. All right. So Jenny says, I have a giant heap of wood chips. If I dig a hole in there and put some soil in it, do you think some acid loving plants would grow in it? Maybe blueberries? Full sun.
That's an interesting question, because if you dig a hole in the wood chips and put soil, is that?
Yeah.
No, I would, you rake away the wood chips, plant the blueberry in the ground, and then use the chips as mulch.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like Jenny doesn't want to move that wood pile.
Yeah.
She's shaking her head no.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no, you have to do that. All right, so, you know, Henry mentioned pruning, and this is always where people get confused in the spring. What can I prune now? And pretty much like with the lilacs when they're done blooming, same thing with the forsythia.
Yeah. But if your forsythia is, mine's almost done. I actually pruned a lot of it earlier this spring because the weight of that, we had a couple of really heavy, heavy, wet snow, and the weight of it just broke some major, major branches. So I pruned it fairly severely before it even bloomed. It looks lovely anyway. But for forsythia, if it's a large plant, don't give it a crew cut. I mean, they have a beautiful, natural sort of fountain-like shape. Go in and take out some of the oldest stems right at the ground. You know, one of the largest, oldest stems. Take out one or two of them, maybe three of them, every year. And it just will keep the shrub renewed and flowering freely every year. The spring flowering shrubs, you want to prune them right after they finish blooming. Yeah. For summer flowering shrubs, like the panicle hydrangeas, I pruned mine in April.
Yeah. You know, I would say
you still can. It's
I leave
not
them,
too late.
They're so pretty in the wintertime.
Yes, they
are. And
yeah.
I just wait. Yeah, same thing in the spring. I go in and cut up all the old dead heads of the flowers. We should also mention, you know, a lot of people, you get excited now. You're in there and you're buying your basil and your tomatoes, and a little too early to put the basil out.
Well, you know, I as we've discussed, I work part time in one of our fine local garden centers here on the Cape, and we actually have signs up saying, "No, it's too soon."
Yeah.
So tomatoes and peppers, unless you're going to take efforts to protect them and shelter them, basil, it's what you want to look at is nighttime temperatures. We want them to be consistently over 50 degrees. Now, it was in the 50s last night, and it's going to be in the 50s tonight. And then Wednesday night, it's going to be in the 40s. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's not consistently over 50 degrees. So another week, you know, the season is just not progressing quite as fast as we'd like. And then we'll go directly into summer and we'll all complain. You know, it's like, no, we can't complain because we had endless winter this year. Yeah. So it's that nighttime temperature. Can you plant your tomatoes out right now? Sure you can. They're not going to die,
but they're
not going to thrive. You know, same with marigolds. We have marigolds in still in the greenhouse, not outside on the benches, because under cool night temperatures, they turn purple, and then people don't want to buy them.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing is true of tomatoes. If you plant them and it's still cool, and the soil, people don't think of soil temperature, but if the soil temperature is still kind of chilly, they just sit there, you know. And if you wait 2 weeks and plant them then, they'll catch up with anything you planted earlier and maybe even surpass it.
Yeah. We should just find a minute here. We should mention the neonicotinoids. We want to look at the labels. The local garden centers, I think, they're all great. They're not using them.
They are not using them.
And they know their stock and where it's coming from.
Exactly.
But some of the big box stores, not so much. They're coming from other areas. And you really want to look at the labels.
You don't want to be planting flowering plants that have been treated with neonics, because it's translocated through the plant and it gets into the pollen and the nectar. And so when our pollinators visit these plants that have been treated with Neonix, they can be poisoned. So ask your vendor. Mm-hmm. Most of our local garden centers, as far as I know, do not sell products that have been treated, but some of the larger box stores do.
So we want to be careful of that. So we'll see you next month.
Yes, you will.
Roberta, when things should be hopping.
I hope so.
Thanks for listening. I'm Mindy Todd.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.